Why don't I start? Welcome everybody to this panel. The goal of this panel is to review the last decade and think about the next decade in open hardware. My name is Aya Bader. I'm the founder and former CEO of Littlebits. And as I, if you were in the opening talk, also one of the co-founders of the Open Hardware Summit. Today we have a really exciting panel with us to talk about the past decade and the future decade in open hardware. We have representatives from academia, we have representatives from startups, from small business and from medium business, and really can talk about what is the impact of open hardware, both positive and negative, from all aspects of business and academia and really community. First, I want to start by introducing our panelists. If you can wave when it's when your name is called up. So first up, I have, I'll start with Glenn Samala from Spark Fund. Glenn is the CEO of Spark Fund. Before joining Spark Fund, he was Senior Director and General Manager of Global Business for Arrow Electronics. And so we're very happy to have Glenn because he can bring the experience of being at Arrow and seeing really large scale hardware, but also doing it at Spark Fund in Colorado. Hi, Glenn. Next up, we have, I'll go out of order, Leonard Edman, co-founder of Evil Mad Scientist Lab. Leonard's been working with open source hardware since 2007 and has been the most one of the most loyal Open Hardware Summit attendees also and participants since the early days. And Leonard's work sits at the intersection of electronics, crafting, science, art, and education. Hi, Leonard. Next up, we have Christina. Christina is the founder, is a hardware entrepreneur. Her background is in biochemistry, physics, engineering, and has also experience in both hardware and software engineering. She has built multiple products, and her last current product that she's building is a Detours 4G LTE Android version of the Circle phone. I love the tagline, a non-rectangular phone for non-rectangular people. That's visual. Welcome, Christina. We also have founder and CEO of System 76, who's brought production of desktop systems in-house. System 76 is the only computer manufacturer in the US, so that'll be really interesting to talk about as well. Hi, Carl. And I think we don't have Nadia yet. I will introduce her as she jumps on. But why don't I kind of get started? So I think for me, when I thought about sort of overview of the past decade and the future decade in open hardware, I thought what would be really relevant is to be sort of very open and honest with the community about some of the trials and tribulations that we've been through in the past decade, but also some of the magic that we want to carry forward. I know at Littlebits, we embarked on being a fully open source hardware company. And when we launched the first 3 years, it was a huge part of investment that we did. And at some point, we had to deprioritize that investment because of its impact on business, on cost, on kind of our community interactions. And so I know firsthand this idea of having to sort of balance realities and ideologies. And so I'd really like to invite our panelists to be really sort of open about some of the issues that they've come across. My first question is a question for everybody. So it's been 10 years in open hardware. Name one thing that you think has improved over the last 10 years and one thing that you think that went backwards over the past 10 years. Maybe I'll start with you. Leonard, I'll start with you.
Sure. One of the things that has really improved is our connections, that there's so much more access to information. The infrastructure for open hardware has increased and improved just incredibly. So the number of connections that we have in the community is just absolutely incredible. And then one thing that has gone backwards. So there's still an open question about what we do when somebody calls something open hardware and it isn't. And that becomes more and more prevalent as more and more people become involved in this community and take advantage of this community. So that's one thing that I think is still a thorn, and even a bigger thorn, because people will use the name when they shouldn't.
Yeah, and that's an ongoing project that I know Ashwa is working on. Glenn, what are your thoughts? One thing that has improved over the past 10 years, one thing that went backwards.
I think, you know, from my perspective, you know, the fact that from an open source hardware perspective, it's a known, more of a known entity in the business community, which I think is beneficial to all of us. I think one of the biggest challenges for those who aren't familiar with open source in the business community, the question is always automatically, how do you monetize this or how do you scale this? And I think it's really trying to get those discussions going, getting beyond the, you know, the barriers first. But I just think overall, in terms of the presence and people knowing more about the open source hardware community is good for all of us. And I think it's how do we bridge that gap in a bigger, broader sense with the business community will be one of the challenges that we have moving forward. But I agree with Lenore in terms of sort of defining what open source hardware means is going to be critical for this team and this community moving forward, just so we could really align on what that operational definition is, so we could tell a consistent story across the board.
I was hoping for some kind of big explosive scandals on what's gone backwards, but so far it's been tame. So Nadia, what has improved over the past 10 years and what's gone backwards?
I mean, I think almost everything has improved. Right now we have some annoying things that have to do with tariffs, lame, but the overall, you know, I have graduate students now who tell me, back when you were trying to build stuff, it was impossible for you to get parts. And now you can buy, you know, extrusions, you can 3D printers are reliable. There's like all kinds of, there's all kinds of different places where you can buy lots and lots and lots of parts. And the marketplace for those kinds of things is really accessible now in low volume. Sixth person. I think that the difficulty there that remains, and this isn't so much something that's gotten worse, but just something that we have to deal with, is like, as you have more marketplaces and different places to get parts, you have to make sure you have quality control of all of those different things. So every time you get like a new fastener or a new chip, you want to make sure that it actually is going to work in the design that you have. And figuring out how to do distributed quality control for open source hardware, I think, is something that we still haven't really figured out. Luckily, Waz is leading the charge in making sure we have all the tools we need for the future.
Passing on the buck. Carl, let's jump over to you. What do you think has improved over the past 10 years and what's gone backwards?
Well, I agree with Glenn's.
You can't really hear you all that well.
Yes, let me turn on my mic here.
Can you hear me better?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, excellent. I agree with Glenn. I think that the exposure of open hardware and open source software also helps in this, and that its adoption has grown so widespread that open hardware is a natural extension of that, and companies that are producing products are interested in both the leveraging the open source software and its community, and open hardware seems to be a natural extension to that. As far as challenges, I think making our open source designs more useful to people is probably one of the largest challenges I see. When we produce open source software, it's digital. If it's useful to people, it is. There's a community builds around it relatively fast. We see bug reports, we see pull requests, we see things grow and move and energy around it. Since launching our Thaleo product line and open source desktop product, the participation in the design is very, very different, much, much smaller than it is in open source community. And I would attribute that both to, you know, how young this community is, as well as to the difficulty with which someone can take a design and make it useful for themselves. So I'd love to see us work towards making maker spaces and other places where you can take these designs and produce them yourself more accessible and part of the community.
So we'll talk about makerspaces in a bit. That's something that Christina did an overview of that I'd like to share. I'd like her to share with others. I think it's a really good point. But let's first talk to Christina about what do you think has improved over the past 10 years of open hardware and what has gone backwards?
So I think that, you know, definitely we've had more sharing and of course with the growth in makerspaces, that's been really encouraging. Just getting the word out there, also getting people used to the idea of open source hardware, I think is really important. You know, like Nadia pointed out, the tariffs have been a real bummer, at least in our industry, so.
Yeah. That's something also that's definitely exacerbated even by the situation that we're in right now. So we'll all have to watch how it goes. The things that are kind of common across what people talked about, community awareness, more ability to kind of make connections between people, I think those are really positive things. I know also that in academia, a little bit less, but definitely in startups, small business and medium business, open hardware is hard. It's hard to do. It's a lot of extra overhead and investment, time investment, financial investment, documentation investment, and it adds quite a bit of overhead on everybody's workload. So the question to everybody on the panel is, why do you still do it? What is your motivation to keep making your hardware open? Whoever wants to jump in, please go ahead.
For me, it's giving back to the community that gave so freely to me. So I wouldn't be
here. A sense of loyalty.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think for System 76, open source is just a founding principle of our purpose and our what we work on. If for us, open source means sharing knowledge. Sharing knowledge means it's more accessible to more people. And more accessibility means people have more opportunities. If you know, we've had the opportunity to invest as a company to design hardware and PCBs and backplanes and things like that. Now people can take those designs, learn from them, and use them, adapt them, build their own designs off of them. I think that the real value in open source is simply that, is that knowledge can spread and it isn't locked up into institutions or companies any longer. It's now everyone's knowledge.
So from your perspective, participating in it, taking on that extra overhead is a sense of duty or a sense of mission or a sense of ideology.
I disagree with that, but I definitely don't think it is my prime motivator. I think that like reproducibility is really important, being able to replicate systems. I think it's hard to rely on things that you don't know how they work. And if you want to be able to verify and make sure that the thing that you're telling it to do is actually doing, mm-hmm. then without being able to see in it, you can't guarantee that. People can't extend and customize things if they're not open and designed to be extensible in that way. Overall, I think closed systems just break. They're not robust, and they don't have the smartness of everyone able to figure out flaws and fix them.
I want to build on Nadia said about extensibility, that by making our products open, we reach different audiences. Because there's more documentation about it and they can learn more about the product, they can do different things with it than we anticipate. So we're always learning about people using our things for ways that we had no idea that they would. We didn't expect that they would use it for this thing. And they only do that because it's documented well enough that they're able to repurpose it.
Not only that, I mean, if I can talk about Lenora's tools, like the AxiDraw, for example, has a really robust software component that goes together with the hardware. And without being able to do like the full end-to-end open source system, you can't get it to do whatever the weird things are that you want it to be able to do.
The AxiDraw is an interesting example, because part of it is not open source, but part of the hardware is, and it's an iterative design that comes from an early fully open source hardware project, the Eggbot, which was started back in 2010. So the ActiDraw wouldn't be here without open hardware, that it's been built on this, you know, series of machines that came out of an open hardware project.
Yeah, I mean, from a Sparkfun perspective, the easy answer is we are an open source hardware company. That is our DNA. That's how we started. I could tell you in terms of why we continue to open source, it makes us a better company, right? I think part of our mission from a Sparkfun perspective is to really, you know, do new product introductions, give access to the folks on new technologies, both software and hardware, as much as we can. And, you know, from an open source perspective, it just makes us better, right? I think, you know, but it's also a challenge, quite honestly, right? I'm sure you've been through this. I think it forces you to keep coming up with iterations and new products. And you have to keep focused on the next big thing, the next technology, whatever interests the community. You can't cash cow a product for a year or two. And that's okay by us, because again, our mission is to make technology available and make new products available as quickly as possible. I mean, it just makes us a better company.
Yeah.
Honestly, from a technology
perspective. I think one demoralizing thing about that is whenever you open yourself up, you also are inviting all the criticism. And it really is the thing that makes you better. But, you know, sometimes you open up your pull requests and you're like, oh God, everybody hates me. I just do terrible shit.
But overall, in technology space, right, regardless if you're open or closed, the reality is the technology market doesn't reward sort of the status quo, doesn't reward sort of the standards, right? And so from an open hardware perspective, you know, that's an advantage for us. And I think
if you can get that feedback, it improves your product faster than it does for someone who doesn't get that feedback.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, and to your point, when you're doing something that's open source, I think you tend to put more care into it because you know you're going to be exposed. I know this is true in software. I think it's true in hardware just as much.
It keeps you in check. We say that a lot here, right? It keeps us honest.
Yeah,
so. I mean, there is something that Carl mentioned earlier that at Little Bits we experienced a lot. So in the first few years, we were very, very focused on making everything that we delivered open source. It took an incredible amount of overhead, and especially since Little Bits is a large platform, there's over, you know, 80 bits. It adds a ton of overhead per bit. But at one point, we noticed that all the extra work, there was only a handful of people that were looking at the documentation or looking at the board. So we were doing all this extra work that was hundreds and hundreds of hours of people's time, and really a very, very tiny community of people were looking at it. And arguably, it wasn't necessary. And so we had to deprioritize that because, as Glenn was saying, you are under pressure to deliver innovative products. You have to have timelines that you want to hit. Particularly, we were working on timelines of the school year or Christmas. And so we had to make a difficult call to, you know, the last third of the bits. We didn't do as much work on opening them up. So it was kind of a constant struggle. So it's interesting to hear, you know, from all of you, the drive that is, you know, Nadia saying scalability, resilience of the product, Lenore saying that, you know, it makes you find uses that you didn't think about before. These are all real benefits that definitely counter some of the difficulty, but it is difficult for sure. Which brings me to one of the most difficult aspects of producing hardware for anybody, but I think open hardware adds a layer of complexity, which is supply chain manufacturing. I would love to hear about your supply chain nightmares. Who has a supply chain nightmare to share with the community? The reason I ask that question is I know that there are a lot of either beginners or early hardware developers in their career in the audience, and I really am a fan of people not thinking that they are doing something wrong and there's something wrong with them, and for them to understand from everybody that these are hard things for any developer. So you know, your supply chain nightmares. Any volunteers?
All of the above.
Yeah.
I mean, I could tell you one thing that it has forced us to do, and really, it's almost like in the spirit of open source hardware, right? It forced us to consider and think differently about our supply chain channels. Too easily, we go to China's sort of the solution, and it just forces us. It forced us to think in that, you know, towards the end of December, what are the other alternatives? You know, it's a big world out there. So it really, again, put us in check and sort of challenged our status quo. So if there's anything good that came out of it, at least from my perspective, it really forced the team to think differently about sort of supply chain management, how we should look at it differently, whether it's normal course of business or if there's a second contingency plan we need to consider. Yeah. But yeah, supply's been, as we all know on this panel, it's been difficult. But yeah, all
the sourcing raw materials. Yeah, exactly. Anybody else? Any manufacturing disaster, compliance disaster, fire on the line, shipment stuck in Timbuktu?
Yeah, I can share one for certain, and one of many, many different challenges. But in one of our components, we use rivnuts. It's a small nut that compresses against aluminum, and you can use it to put threads into aluminum. We like to use steel rivnuts because aluminum is too soft, and so threads a lot of times will pull out. Well, we order tens of thousands of these at a time, and when they arrive, we popped open the box and everything was fine, and so we started using them, and we popped open the second box, and it was rusted. The third box was rusted, the fourth box, which the fifth one was rusted. We learned that day that when you get a shipment, you open everything and inspect it, because then you have to wait 3 weeks to get your new, to get new set, and maybe that halts production. So, that was a tough lesson learned.
Not a fun activity. Christina, you're nodding. You have a story.
So with our first phone, before we even launched the Kickstarter campaign, you know, it was interesting because it was our first time, and we had reluctantly, because it was just our tester that we had slapped together for our testers, but then people started asking to buy it. So it was actually a kit that we reformulated from Seed Studio. And so we ordered a couple of hundred kits from Seed Studio in preparation, and they got caught in customs in Alaska for over a month. And that was a huge wake-up call for us because we were helpless. We didn't know why they had been caught. We didn't know how long it was going to take for them to get out of, you know, limbo. And we realized, we realized that we would have to carry the overhead of all of our employees during any delays. So because of that, we actually shifted to a more contractor model and employed people on contractor short-term basis to keep kind of our overhead down. And typically companies don't like to do that, especially if they're raising revenue, because you want to show a large team and all of that kind of stuff. But for us, we just really had to work on a shoestring. So the second thing that forced us to do was, for example, for this second phone, we have most of our inventory is available stateside, and we manufacture in Seattle. We do everything in Seattle. The only parts that we source from China that are inventoried in China are the display and the battery. So those are the parts that we will have to wait for to assemble the phone. But in the meantime, we can assemble the whole board and test all the units with the sample displays and sample batteries. So yes, it was really a good heads up for us that first year, and we've been developing our system since then.
Yeah. Getting some of those lessons early on is effective to kind of build resilience into your supply chain, because they will invariably happen. The sooner you know, the better.
Right, so, and also having backup components, you know, to be able to replace out and to make sure that, and then that also helps with open source. Other people have pointed this out as well. If you share out your board and somebody wants to swap out a part, it's much easier.
Yeah,
if you don't have specialty parts.
So we had a supplier not too long ago helpfully substitute a stainless steel nut for a zinc plated nut because it was higher quality. And so we had to communicate much more clearly that no, that actually had to be a zinc plated nut because of issues with it seizing. And it was just, they were like, oh, but you want the highest quality thing. And so the difficulty was in communicating the exact specifications rather than, you know, some nebulous, I want the best thing with our suppliers. It's been interesting working with learning to communicate which things are important. Even with a supplier that you've worked with for years, you still have to keep in mind exactly which things are important to communicate about a particular part, even something as simple as a nut.
Yeah. And that's another important part about the coronavirus occurring is that we've actually been approached in the last month by a large, I can't say their name, but large manufacturer of other phones in America, of American phones. And they're offering to make our phone in China. And of course, they are exceptional at doing that. But we won't be able to fly there to be boots on the ground to inspect any of the product there and to make sure that it's, you know, within our vision and within our design and things like that. So it's really disabling this whole global situation.
I would encourage people to, after this panel, jump on the Discord and share some of these stories. And if they've come up with solutions that particularly are going to be relevant now, during the coronavirus pandemic, be people that potentially are in China that could help when things ease up a bit. There will be people that have found other solutions or have, you know, stocks of piles of material that could help. And I think that there'll be a lot of solutions within the community. So I would encourage people to go to the Discord channel after that to discuss this.
And there is a COVID-19 specific Discord channel as well.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about, you know, kind of the, in thinking about the next 10 years, how, if, you know, we want to continue growing open source hardware, we want to bolster it, make it stronger. What are, you know, how we understand and analyze some of the tools and enablers that were really helpful in the past decade and the ones that we want to take forward. So when I say tools and enablers, I mean things like design tools, I mean things like community, which was already touched upon, but I also mean tools like media, and I mean tools like institutions, schools, libraries, makerspaces. So I'll start, I guess, with makerspaces, because I think that's relevant for a lot of people. What is the role that makerspaces play in this movement? And Christina, you did a survey of makerspaces that have existed over the past 10 years. Give us a bit of a snapshot of what you found.
So the reason I was doing the research was part of our Kickstarter campaign involved flying to makerspaces throughout the United States and offering to teach people how to assemble the Circle phone in class form. And we did offer to ship Circle phone components and people could assemble them by themselves, but they preferred to have the class along with it. And so I had to do research about which makerspaces we were, which six makerspaces we were going to go to throughout the United States. And it turned out there were, so I based that on the states that had the most makerspaces. And so I contacted the makerspaces, for example, in California, Texas, New York. There were also what I found was when I would start, so I was working off of a list provided by Maker Media, and the list seemed to have been 2 years old at that time, but it was the only list I could find at that time. So I started contacting all of the makerspaces in those states to figure out which ones would be open to be participating, having their name on our Kickstarter campaign. And what I found was about 18% of the makerspaces had gone down by the time that I contacted them. So I got the sense that the list was about 2 years old. So it seemed like, any makerspace after it was established really had about an 80% chance of surviving after it was established. But I think it's really hard. I think makerspaces are an act of love. I think that, and I've talked about this before, but you know, when libraries were first established, they used to be a privilege of the rich, and then they became a public foundation. But I think we're seeing makerspaces move from private makerspaces to more public makerspaces. For example, the makerspaces that have been incorporated in places in libraries. I believe the Los Angeles Library was the first one to do this, but there have been a lot of makerspaces that have popped up in libraries since then. And I think it's a great transition for libraries nowadays to move to the kind of more hardware digital format of sharing, because fewer and fewer people are reading paper books. Gosh, I hope that never goes away. But I think it's a great transition.
Christina, would you be willing to share your list of makerspaces that you found, the ones that are still active? I think that'd be a really useful list for people.
Oh, yes, but I did that in 2016. There are actually better lists of makerspaces out now, and I'm happy to share those lists as well.
So I think would be great. Lenore, we talked about libraries. You work with libraries quite a bit. You work with schools quite a bit. What is the role that schools and libraries play in growing the open hardware movement, and what do we need to do to help them?
That's interesting. I think that the relationship is kind of reversed, that the schools and libraries benefit from the open hardware movement when we create tools that they can use for education. So for instance, if you make a low cost soldering kit that they can use for teaching soldering, that they can buy en masse, they're gonna take advantage of that. Kind of whether it's open source or not, but it's usually more beneficial if it's open source for the reasons that we talked about earlier, that the documentation tends, we hope, is better. And you know, that so much thought has been put into it. And then from a tools perspective, more and more makerspaces are getting things like 3D printers and other digital fabrication tools, even pen plotters, vinyl cutters, those kinds of things. And the more open they are, the more the libraries and makerspaces can maintain them, because your costs are limited, or your funds are limited for these kinds of things, typically in these types of institutions, because you're usually in resource restricted situations. So the open source hardware projects tend to be a good fit for those environments, in part because we can make them last longer, because they have a community around them, because they can look it up online and see how somebody else resolved the problem that they're seeing now.
Nadia, you did quite a bit of research on open source manufacturing. That's also obviously a big enabler or a component that I think is going to be important in the whole movement. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I don't know exactly how to characterize it well, but I guess maybe a difference between me and the other people on this panel are I don't ship product. I just like gallivant around in the magical world of academia. And so one of the things that I think is really interesting to explore is what would it mean to not have manufacturers? At what point do we have enough documentation, enough source that everyone can make everything on their own? And I don't mean that in like a hypothetical everyone where everyone is no one, but really what does it take for people who aren't experts, who don't necessarily have training in production, to be able to buy parts on a list and assemble machines, tools, and other kinds of things. And there, I think a lot of the time, what we rely on is the historical, we rely on the historical way that things have been made in the past. And then we try to kind of shrink it or make it into something that fits in a makerspace. And fundamentally, I think there's something really broken about that, about how changing, just making infrastructure like cheaper or somehow easier to get into a space doesn't necessarily make it easy to use or well suited to the people who are going to have access to it. So I like to think about, what is the fabricatability of this thing? What are the tools you need to make it? What is the expertise you need to make it? How can people get that expertise? How can people get the parts? And that's, I think, an interesting starting point for, what distributed manufacturing, open manufacturing would really look like. I don't know. I have a lot. I feel like I'll hijack the panel if I talk about this for too long.
I mean, it's an interesting breakout. It's an interesting other conversation. If people are interested, definitely this conversation should continue on the Discord channel. Carl and Glenn, both of you manufacture in the U.S. Carl, you guys manufacture computers. Glenn, you guys manufacture all sorts of small and large hardware. What are some of the tools that have changed over time that have enabled design tools or production tools, manufacturing tools that have changed over the past decade that you think are going to be enablers for the open hardware movement?
That's a tricky question.
Yeah, it is.
Because so our company's been grown organically. We started in my basement 15 years ago.
We can't
be here. My company's been, Susan 26 has been grown organically over 15 years. It started in my basement there, you know, from essentially nothing. And we didn't jump into manufacturing until we had the capital to buy the type of machinery that was necessary to do it. And so that's where I struggle as well. One idea, just listening to the panel, was potentially partnering with universities that have a lot of this machinery so that at least people could gain the expertise to manufacture products. And it's a lot different than distributing.
Well, I feel like can we just spend of like one thing? Makerspaces aren't just like a bunch of tools. Makerspaces are people with expertise that help other people do stuff. Mm-hmm. And being like, oh, you know, universities have tools. Worked in a lot of universities, and a lot of times it's just like a pile of rust. It doesn't work. It doesn't help to say, oh, you know, some rich person donated a bunch of this stuff and now everyone has access to it. It's really not true. If the tools aren't usable, if they're not designed for lots of novices to come and do different kinds of stuff, then having a makerspace is like meaningless.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, I went to Metro here before we started manufacturing. Because they have a program for machinists and other other folks that are interested in this type of manufacturing work, and so they had lasers, they had lathes, they had the machinery, and I learned a lot there as well because we were just learning how to manufacture, and so I don't have the answer to make this more accessible, but perhaps finding those places where they're available, and then those of us that are doing manufacturing, some of the guys here and folks here. Have talked about potentially having classes to bring people in and show them what's about it if there's interest in manufacturing.
But I think that they're also like the educational pipeline thing is a little bit of a, you know, it's not about learning to use the tools that already exist. Plenty of these tools suck. Like we all still use G-code. Why? it's like a two-way street. Yes, we want more people who can do stuff with these tools, but at the same time, you know, we are now in the position where we can change all of these tools. So doing more of that, I think, is also a great way to start chipping away at this problem.
But are you saying, Nadia, we need more? You're saying we need to improve the tools or we need other tools?
I think both, all of the above. And also, I think we really need to celebrate the people who are doing the maintenance and the education and making that a really valuable component of it. I think, you know, one thing, I've been involved in a lot of makerspaces for a long time, and like makerspace manager burnout is a real thing. It's the ones that just like fold or go away, or like you come back a few years later and everything is just broke and hasn't been used for a while. Like, what do we do about that?
Yeah, but I would argue that's not a tool problem. That's supporting the community.
It does have to do with the tool, I think, because if you are requiring, right now, we're requiring people who use makerspace tools to effectively do a miniaturized version of exactly the same CNC workflow that people did in the 1960s. And so we've come a long way in making things really usable. We can have like toddlers using iPads. So why are they not using robot arms?
So one of the success stories, I think, in design tools is KiCad, that they've had increased development, significant tool improvement, and education. They have people publishing tutorials and footprint libraries and all of those things where suddenly you really can learn to do EDA, but it still has its roots in those 60s design practices, but it's getting better. And it is more accessible because those communities have come together and are doing the education as well as the development.
Glenn, any thoughts on?
Yeah, I mean, this is clearly a difficult discussion, right? I think in the spirit of what we want to do, what we want to bring to the community, we want to provide that availability, want to provide the tool sets. But quite candidly, what it comes down to is how do we model this in such a way that it could maintain itself, frankly, from a financial perspective, right? We do what we can from a Spark perspective to reach out to the community and build things. And we've done it in terms of, you know, an idea, we bring it to the Spark Fund store and we sell it. But I think in a broader sense, from a community perspective, what is the right model, right? How do we get to that point? And I, you know, this, like there's a point from a business perspective. Spark Fund's been in business for, oh my gosh, 17 years now. And so there's this challenge of keeping the lights on, but contributing to community in a bigger part of fashion. And what does that balance look like? Quite candidly, I don't know. We've tried so many different things. And Nadia, to your point, it's not just giving access and giving the tool sets. It's how do you enable them? How do you educate them? And that requires time and effort. And quite candidly, schools are also a challenge for us, right? We want to be in that space. We are in that space. But there's also a lot of heavy lift in terms of the educational training, them getting up to speed on what is an Arduino. And so we have feet on the street, but that's a big heavy lift for a lot of organizations. And we'll continue to sort of push that forward. But as a community, as business leaders, we need to think about what does the right model look like? And what does that balanced model look like that benefits everyone? It's a difficult topic.
I just wanted to give a shout out to Spark Fund. Thank you for bringing all of your cellular boards online. In the last year, I've really noticed and really appreciated it.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
These things are important to say because I definitely relate to what Glenn is saying. It's a lot of extra work, a lot of extra overhead when you're running a company. On one hand, you're trying to take care of your employees, making sure that everybody is happy, well paid, and doing interesting work. You have to take care of investors or people that have funded the company. You have to make sure the company can stand on its feet and be sustainable. You also want to take care of the customer, give them something at a price that they are willing to pay and not more. You want to take care of the early adopters or the one percenters that are never happy with how things work. It's a difficult balance to bring everything together. And so many times you don't have time to kind of reinvent the tool chain and have to use what's around. It ends up being subpar for everybody, but it's sort of, you know, maybe you have to
Well, I want to build on what Aya was saying, that the documentation part of it and the education part of it is super important. But one of the ways that we started as a company was actually not as a company, but as a project blog. We started by telling people how to do things. And so that's been one of the reasons that Open Hardware was a good fit for us, is because we started from that perspective of let's show people how to do things. Yep. And so some of the things that we sell the most of are gumdrop LEDs and pager motors, which neither of which are particularly open source. They're just components. But because we make them accessible and we describe them in a way that teachers find friendly, you know, they'll buy it from us because they can understand how to use it because of the ways that we describe it. And that's one of the ways that we solve that problem of connecting with the classrooms, is trying to have really inclusive language in all of our documentation. And we fail at that sometimes. Some of our documentation is probably too technical or less inviting than it could be. But we do sell a lot of gumdrop LEDs. Yeah.
So we have about 10 minutes left. I want to take some questions from the audience, but I do, I would be remiss to leave a topic unspoken about in this panel, which is Make Magazine and Maker Media. Obviously, Make Magazine and Maker Media was a very big proponent, evangelist, and kind of pillar in propping up the open hardware movement and supporting many of our businesses, projects, academic research. What has the dissolution of Maker Media meant to the movement? It's propped up in different forms now, so it's more community driven, and there's great work being done on that front. But what does it being gone mean, and what will it mean for the future?
So one of the things that I've noticed is that we don't have as many in-person, and this is exacerbated, of course, by the current situation, in-person opportunities to connect with other people like ourselves. So Maker Faire, although I loved the interaction with the public, was more important to me as a way to connect with people like me who are making kits for that community. And so that's the thing that I miss the most. The things that are gone that I think are less tragic were going away anyway. So Metro Magazine as a hub for people to go and get information. Well, there aren't those hubs anymore. There are Facebooks and there are Twitters and there are Instagrams, but there aren't the same kinds of blog hubs and central sources of information. Our community is much, much more distributed. And that coincided with Maker Media's fall. I don't know how much it contributed to it, but so I think that's less of a loss now because it was going away anyway.
What are other people's comments on that? Nadia, you look like you have some thoughts. Oh, you're muted, I think. Hi. We can't hear you. No. Who can read sign language? That's not reading sign language. Anybody else thoughts on Maker Media?
As far as the Maker Faire is going away, I really miss, like Lenore pointed out, the water cooler talks, just the casual conversations that you would have in person with people. You know, for example, saying, oh, I no longer use threaded inserts in my prints because, you know, I found the 2.5, you know, millimeter screw works just fine for the limited number of times that I need to, you know, screw and unscrew it and things like that. I mean, those things you may not say in, for example, if you're giving a talk, but just those casual conversations really meant a lot to me.
Yeah. I mean, the software community in some sense never had that and never seemed to need it. So I guess maybe it's a challenge for the hardware community to try to figure out how to use software and the web in a more efficient way to make those things happen. Incredible. Huge pieces of software have been written with people that I've never met before, never been able to have water cooler talks, never been able to share anything in person. So I think there's many other reasons I'm very, very sad about Maker Media and Maker Faire not being around, but I do hope that they come in a different form and they seem to have kind of started that.
Nadia. Hot take. Make Media was deeply problematic in a bunch of different ways, and there are a bunch of other people that are doing a better job. There's like a lot of people. I don't know. There's Adafruit and SparkFun have like lots of educational resources. Hackaday SuperCon is an awesome con. Teardown is awesome, the crowd supply one. There's like Murph, Earth, all the Earth, all of those. Yeah, I don't know. I was getting kind of tired of being accosted by giant cupcakes.
All right. So on that note, on cupcake note, let's take some questions from the audience. So there's a few that were picked out for us that I'm going to tackle. One simple one, let's try to keep those super short so we can take a few. One simple one, how long should the team continue to support a piece of open hardware after they discontinue it? Maybe I'll talk, you know, ask Glenn and Carl, Christina, everybody, please. Anybody who has an answer, feel free to jump in.
I think the typical length of time is 5 years. And in business, at least, in selling products, 3 years is the typical warranty that you need to support up to, and most companies move to 5 years.
5 years.
We just got a tech support request yesterday for a product that we launched in 2008 and haven't really discontinued, but haven't updated in 5 years. So we're still supporting it, but it's low volume. So we've never really stopped supporting pretty much anything.
Yeah, well, I can tell you from a Sparfun perspective, it's very, very rare to put something EOL. We have stuff that Nate came up with, 15 years ago that's still out there. I think so long as there's demand, we'll have it out there. So, I mean, that's, we do have an advantage from a manufacturing perspective that everything's in-house. So we can manage sort of the cost overhead appropriately. We could support older products so long as we continue to come up with newer products that could help feed the engine as well. Right. If we get to a position where we're just cast cow older products, then we're out of business tomorrow. But from a Sparfun perspective, we tend to hold on to things much longer, frankly, than I would like in some cases. But I get why we do it. So
that makes sense. And for me, I try to just follow what other people have demonstrated. So one of the first phones that I cut my teeth on was David Melis's 2012 phone. And he was still supporting that, years later. And so I really watch what other people do. And so it makes me kind of wonder how long we need to support, and maybe we need to, for example, for our phones, set expectations up front, we will support this for 2 years, because it's a large undertaking and we have limited staff. So
yeah, there's also a distinction between technical support and hardware replacement or RMAs. Mm-hmm. I think for technical support, we offer lifetime support. So until the thing just dies, you can call us and talk to us. But the ability to replace components inside of the computer is, in our case, somewhat limited by the upstream warranties that we are beholden to from memory suppliers and so forth. That being said, when things do run out, I think a good policy to have is that you replace something that's broken under warranty with equivalent or better. And so sometimes you can't buy the same memory or replace memory for a customer exactly, but replacing it with equivalent or better is a good practice.
Yeah, and last comment on this from a Sparkling perspective, we also benefit from the fact that we're not tied to a funnel end use product, right? We go to market with all the puzzle pieces that people need to make something. And sometimes those puzzle pieces last 15, 20 years, and we're actually okay with that. So
So it sounds like we have we have 5 extra minutes, so we can keep going with a few other questions. I think this question is pretty important. On the topic of compliance, what are your experiences with gaining certifications, CE, UL, FCC, on commercial open hardware? If I was on the panelist side, I would talk about this for 75 hours, because making open source hardware products for kids that are exposed circuit boards that are for education and have magnets in them are probably the worst Venn diagram anybody can ever embark on in the world, and also have white circuit boards. So I'm not going to speak because I would hog the conversation, but please, whoever has experience, I think CE is really important, CE and UL, FCC, of course. Any sort of feedback on how to get these certifications and how to make them easier for people that are getting started?
It's
where do I start? Yeah. So for us, it's kind of frustrating for us because we source all of our inventory from the United States. We manufacture in the United States, and yet the most cost-effective and most knowledgeable solution in these certifications are actually in China. So we will have to send test units to China to get certified for America, which just blows my mind. There are excellent certification companies in California, but they cost an arm and a leg, and we can't afford them at this point. So it's just easier for us to send our units to China to get certified at this point.
So I actually, I wasn't kidding. I do have quite a bit of experience with that. But we do have, we had some excellent relationships with people in the US that did certifications. We actually had a little bit team member that recently started his own shop to do that for companies. if people are interested, get in touch with me and I will introduce you. He's just an incredible person and has so much knowledge and so many contacts, both in the US and abroad, and can really help on that front. But it's painful, painful process.
Fantastic. Thank you.
All right. Another question that I think is important is releasing source file, design file, BOM, and backend code enough, or does really being open, good open hardware maker require very extensive documentation and dev tools?
Documentation is definitely required as part of the open hardware definition, but I think that doing a good job of that is definitely required, and that I think a lot of people don't even to some extent, figuring out what kind of documentation we can write so people can replicate and build upon our work is something, I don't know, I'll just call myself out. I don't always do the best job of, but I do think it's very, very, very important.
Yeah.
It's hard for someone who makes hardware to know what information someone who doesn't make hardware needs to be able to replicate your project. We're too close to it. So it's hard for us to see what documentation is required, unless we're doing the kind of documentation internally to enable our own production to be really good. So that's kind of unusual so I think many of us are so close that it makes it hard, but yes.
I'm actually doing a project on this right now where we have this multi-headed machine where it picks up and drops off different tools called Jubilee. And there we're actually doing a research project where we're testing the documentation. We're like figuring out what are the attributes of documentation of electromechanical devices that is important for people to be able to replicate them if they had access to the kinds of tools you might find in a makerspace.
I will look forward to that research coming out.
Conclusions are you need a lot of documentation. Lots and lots and lots and lots and lots.
It's fun. Don't deter people. We're trying to encourage people. All right. Next question. Sometimes open source means building a smaller business than your investors or customers or colleagues wish it could be. How do you avoid the temptation to scale your company past the point where it may be impractical to best cater to open source minded customers? I think the way I understand the question is, if you have investors, there's pressure to not be open source, or customers want a certain level of delivery or product that being open source makes difficult in terms of kind of out of box experience or UX or things like that, or colleagues, same thing. Is it really a decision between scaling the company and being open source, or do you have to resist temptation to scale because it becomes impractical to be open source?
I think you have scale issues regardless if you're open source or not, honestly. And I think, you know, the same business challenge you have in a closed source model and open, they're all the same. I think from my perspective, open source just teases it out or again, keeps you in check a lot sooner. And so from an investor perspective, I don't know how to answer that because we're totally bootstrapped here at SparkFun. But I will often get asked the question, again, having worked at Arrow for over 20 years, how is it running an open source hardware company versus something like Arrow? And frankly, the answer is really not that different. We all have the same challenges, cash flow, working capital, inventory turns, product releases. We just have to do it faster because of our model. And I also think people need to keep in mind, what market are you entering from an open source hardware perspective? It works for us because, again, we focus on the building blocks, or we focus on the puzzle pieces. Candidly, that might be a different discussion if you're looking at it from an use or end user perspective. I'm sure you probably have some challenges there. And those challenges will be different than SparkFun's because, again, we're focused more on the bits and pieces versus the final product. But I honestly think it's an easy out for most folks to say, you know, it's just harder for open source art. Honestly, I think they're all the same challenges.
I think I would tend to agree. I think the challenges are the same. What I would say, to people is, if you are going to open source your product, just make sure that your offering is not a commodity.
That's exactly right.
Offering is a commodity, and your board can be replicated, and that's what you're offering people. That's not enough. The reason Adafruit and SparkFun succeed in what they're doing is because their value add is in the tutorials, in the videos, in the speed at which they create them and things like that. It's not just replicating the hardware, it does not replicate the product that they've received.
You summed up perfectly, and I'll shut up after this, but to your point, it really is the value beyond the product you're selling, right? And the thing I would encourage people to do, especially startups, is, you know, as you sort of identify what that value is for your product, understand that changes over time. That value becomes expected, right? So, you know, you need to think about what the next thing is in terms of what you wrap around that product set that creates value for your customer. But if you're just looking at it from a pure product perspective, it's not, regardless if you're open source or closed source, it's still a challenge to figure out what the value is.
All right, so one last question to leave this hopefully on a positive note. If you could start your journey again, knowing what you know now, what would you do differently? Question for everybody in the panel.
Well, I can tell you one mistake we made. Although this has much more to do with manufacturing than it does with open source hardware, unfortunately, but one mistake we made was is going cheap on some of the machinery that we purchased or trying to, and then we found that failed miserably and it ended up costing more. So when it comes to producing your products, the things that you're making, make the investment in good machinery.
Don't be cheap.
Yeah.
All right. Another comment. What if you started your journey again, knowing what you know now, what would you do differently?
I think maybe being less shy about learning things. I think it's really, especially now, I think it's an easier landscape to say something like that, where you're like, oh, I'm on YouTube, I have no idea what I'm doing. But I do actually think that a lot of people learn that way, and that maybe in the beginning, being like shy or embarrassed about your own skill set, maybe if I could go back in time, I would be like, it's okay, Nadia, you can talk to the internet. They probably won't eat you.
Or if they did, you don't care.
Not yeah. Care. Yeah, it'll be fine.
Yeah. Others?
Honestly, if I knew everything that I would have to go through at this point, I never would have started. It's been absolutely brutal. And thankfully, I had no idea. You know, I thought, how hard could it be to make a cell phone, to make a smartphone? You know, surely I can do this. I had no idea about supply issues and how difficult it is to get the attention of some suppliers if you're a small company. And also just being taken seriously, you know, being a small company, you know, trying to achieve a very complex product. And that's all been an uphill battle. But wow, I really love my job though. So
the tip is don't ask too many questions before you start.
Exactly. Don't ask too many questions. Just be super curious.
It'll be fine.
And then also, you know, when you have a deadline approaching, you're like, I have to ask this stupid question. I have a deadline approaching. I have to ship product right now. So you know, it forces you into uncomfortable situations that you would normally not ever venture into. And because of that, you know, you grow a tough skin and you become really brave and you're not afraid to ask, you know, the stupid question or be naive about something. You know, say, I have to ship tomorrow, so please can you explain this technical detail to me that, you know, everybody assumes that I should know already, you know, kind of thing. So.
I think that's really the thing, is that if I had been much more forthright about asking questions, that could have made things easier. I don't know if I would have started a business. It's so much work. but knowing how generous this community is and how willing they are to ask questions, if I had known that then, maybe I would have asked more. Maybe I would have learned faster because I would have been more willing to ask the question. So that's a good takeaway, is that this community is really generous. Mm-hmm. If you're in the channels and asking questions, you're probably going to get really good information. So reach out. There are so many experts and people who aren't experts but are willing to help you research things or answer what they know. So
I would have also never learned to solder with leaded solder. Useless skill to be good at. Be gone, leaded solder.
All right. So I think that was a really nice tip for everybody. Don't hesitate to ask questions. The community is very generous. Don't be shy. I would like to use my soapbox for a minute to say something that is very kind of important for me, that I think has always been very important for this open hardware community, that I did know when I started, but I think is even more important today than when I did start, which is design an inclusive environment. From when you start your company, your team, your discussion group, your forum, whatever it is you're designing, design it to be inclusive from day one. That means inclusive to people from different ethnicities, different genders, different technical backgrounds, different languages, because it gets very, very hard afterwards if you don't do that. And it is also extremely important, even more so this day and age. So end of soapbox. Thank you, everybody, for being on this panel.
Thank you,
Aya. Please chat on the Discord afterwards. We were thrilled to have you, and have a great rest of the day.
Thanks, guys. Cheers.